On an old show of the series Everybody Loves Raymond, Raymond's daughter asked a question that got misinterpreted by Raymond and his wife. She said something like, "Well, how did we get here?" And after they thought she was asking for, you know, how did children born and how did we get here? And so Raymond and his wife have a squabble about, you know, well, who's going to talk to her about this? I guess I'll have to. And Raymond says, "Oh, I'll do it. And she's, "Oh, you're going to do it? Have you read the books?" And she pulls out a couple of books, How to Talk to Your Children About Sex. And so Raymond says, "Well, I haven't read the books, but give them to me. I'll read it, and I'll talk to my daughter about this problem." So he gets all the books. He's all ready. He's all done. So he agrees he's going to do it. Well, when he goes in to see her, she says, "Oh, now I'm ready to talk to you." And so he says, now here's how, when daddy and mommy love each other, they want to make babies. And he begins, and she said, "Well, I that's not what I wanted to know." And he said, "Well, what did you want to know?" She said, "I want to know why did God put us here?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Well, if we're all going to go to heaven, why did God put us here? Why didn't he just take us right to heaven?" Now Raymond gets this panicked look, this freaked out look on his face. What do you mean? And now he turns over and he's looking through these sex books, you know, on time. There's nothing in here about how to tell her about why we're here. And so he says, so he gives some kind of a offhanded, "Well, it's because, honey, it's because we're here because heaven is too crowded. It's just too crowded in heaven, and that's why God has to put us here for a while so he can." And she's kind of looking at him really funny, and then he starts to fake a sneeze. He says, I gotta go. I don't want to give you the sneeze." He grabs the books. He tears out of the room. He runs downstairs. He tells his wife, "She doesn't want to know about sex. I got her on prepared. She wants to know about why we're here. Why are we on earth?" So following that, the adults, here come the grandparents over, here comes the brother over, the uncle, and they all now are like, well, what is the purpose of life? Why are we here? Why did God put us here? How come we just don't go directly to heaven? Well, and so they all begin to talk about it, and now they offer this one and that thing, and one of the wives says, I think the purpose is that we're all here so we can serve one another." And of course the grandfather said, "We're all here because, you know, we just have a little pleasure and we get to sit here and we watch a little football," and something like, you know, they're just throwing things out. The grandmother grabs the Bible. She said, "It's right here in the Bible. I can find it." She starts looking. She starts paging through the Bible, and she, and they all continue up and down. "Well, maybe we ought to ask the priest why we're here. Why did God put us here?" Finally, the grandmother comes up with it. She says, "Here, I think I've got it right here in the Proverbs here. Where no oxen are, the crib is clean, but much increase is by the strength of an ox." And they said, "Oh, that's not it. Oh, okay." she starts looking at the Bible again. They call the priest. He's not available. They leave a message. "Father, can you call us back and tell us, you know, something?" Now, these are people, like many people, who attend church every week. They don't even know the purpose of their lives. They don't know even what salvation is. When you say salvation, what do you mean? What does it mean to be saved? Saved from what? Saved for what? So the question then is, why did God put us here? Is there a purpose in life? Most religions expect a future life. But as to why humans are born, why we grow, why we age, why we decline, and why we then die, and often why we suffer during this life, there is little or no understanding, very little in the world today. And what is God's purpose if he lets us suffer. You know, Jesus himself suffered here in the book of Hebrews, chapter 2 and verse 10. We read this. And it saddens me. It just breaks my heart that here are people going to church every week, talking about religion, talking about this, but they don't even know why they were on earth. Why did God put us here? Hebrews 2, verse 10, "For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many children." The word sons is a word that can mean sons and daughters. You know, when the Bible talks about man, he's not talking about just men. It's not a gender thing. It's talking about both genders. "And bringing many children to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings." Greek word is passion. Through the pathos, through the sufferings that we do. He perfected Jesus Christ, the author of our salvation, through the sufferings. The Apostle Paul saying in Romans chapter 8 and verse 18, Paul said, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Now, I want you to notice those two words here. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10, "In bringing many sons to glory," many children to glory. And in Romans 8 and verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 9, talks about the sufferings. "But resist him," meaning the devil. Resist the devil, being firm, stand firm. The word means to not get knocked over. Standing firm means you don't get pushed over. "Standing firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering," I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, "the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished in your brethren who are in the world." So you may be suffering. Other people are suffering. Other brethren, everybody sooner or later has some form of suffering. Now, there are various forms of suffering. There's physical suffering. There's disease suffering. There are various forms of suffering, but sooner or later. And in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 8, "Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered." Why was that important for Jesus Christ to learn obedience? Not that he was disobedient ever, but he learned it. He understood it. He learned it deep within himself. Why was that important that he learned obedience? Romans chapter 5, verse 19 tells us, "For as through the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners." See, you had Adam. Adam was the first man. Through the disobedience of Adam, that's what he's talking about, many were made sinners. "Even so, through the obedience of the one," Jesus Christ, "the many were made righteous." So in Hebrews 5, although he was a son, he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And it was important that he learned that because through his obedience, many are to be made righteous and are made righteous in God's eyes. Now I'd like to turn, I read verse 10 of Hebrews 2, but I'd like to begin in verse 1. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 1. The author of Hebrews here, which we believe is Paul, "For this reason, we must pay much closer attention." He talks about in verse 14 about the Angels are ministering spirits set out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation. We're going to inherit salvation. So then he says, for this reason. You know, all these things that happen, you know, the angels are for us and so on. And for this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard. Hey, you know, you've heard it. Did you ever hear something and then pay attention to it? And then you hear it again and you think, well, maybe I better pay more closer attention to what we have. In other words, you've already heard it. But now it's time to pay closer attention to the things which you have heard. Why? So that we do not drift away from it. We don't want to drift away from the things we've heard. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a penalty, how will we escape if in the ancient times the word, he calls it through angels, and there was an idea that the law came, because you know the angel, you have the angel of the Lord, the angel of the Lord came, and the law came through the spokespersons of the angel. How will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? It's not just being saved, it is a great salvation. After it was first spoken through the Lord, and it was confirmed by those who heard. God also testifying with them both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by the gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. For he did not, listen to this, for he did not subject to angels the world to come. Who's going to be over the world to come? Not the angels. Concerning which we are speaking. This is what the author of Hebrews is saying here. Okay, Paul is saying, concerning which we are speaking. But one testified somewhere. Well, we know where that somewhere was. That's Psalm 8. One testified somewhere saying, what is man that you remember him? To remember something is to keep it in your mind. If I said, I remember you, I have you in my mind. If I remember you today, if I remember you, that's, I have you in my mind. What is man that you talking to God, remember him? Or the son of man, that is children of men, that you are concerned about him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. Now, in the original Hebrew, from the book of Psalm, chapter 8, Psalm, when it says, you have made him a little lower than Elohim, is the Hebrew word. You made him a little lower than Elohim. What's Elohim? In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. You made him a little lower than Elohim. But the Septuagint version translates that, angels. You've made him a little lower than angels. Elohim here, they are saying, when they translated it, they're not saying they can't be Elohim, that must be angels, so they put the angels in there. And the New Testament confirms it, because here we have the inspired New Testament saying it's angels. You have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. You've crowned man. You think you're crowned with glory and honor? To some degree, human beings are crowned. You're made in the very image of God. The human mind, both in males and females, has that power to think and plan and dream and see the future and see the beyond. Human mind is enormous. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You have appointed him over the works of your hands. So in Genesis chapter 1, what did God say to man? I want you to rule over everything. I want you to rule over the fish. I want you to rule over the seas. I want you to rule over the animals. I want you to rule over the creation. I want you to rule over the earth. One thing that God didn't tell man to rule over is what? Other men. Other people. Every one of us has the freedom. You can't be ruled over by somebody else. Now, you know, we have to follow some rules or else we get arrested and all that kind of stuff, you know. And it's better to follow the rules and stop at the stoplight and go on when it's green if you want to save your life and the lives of other people. But you don't rule over them. You have appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. And that's where he stops the quote from Psalm 8. Now he says, for in subjecting all things to him, listen to this statement, he left nothing. This is a literal interpretation of all things. He has put all things under human's feet to rule over. That's what it means to be under your feet, to rule over it. For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. That means to him, meaning male and female. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. We don't see everything subjected to man. Man can't control the weather. Man can't control a lot of things. We don't see everything yet subjected to him. But what do we see? In verse 9, but we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels. Jesus himself made for lower. Jesus, because of the suffering of death, he was crowned with glory and honor so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, through whom are all things, in bringing many sons, many children to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. It was fitting. So when you have many sons, many daughters, and there's a place in the book of 2 Corinthians, you know, the sons and daughters of the Lord, you're the sons and daughters of the Lord. When you have many children and you have a father over them, what would you call that? Would you call that a family? Is God Elohim? Elohim is a plural word for God. It can be translated, if you want to literally say, gods. But it's Elohim, and it is a often used with a singular verb. We'll talk more about that. Now, there's a doctrine going around that said God is only one person. There was some people propounding a doctrine that the Elohim plural word is often used with a singular verb. We know that. Now, had God wanted to convey the teaching that God was only one person, he would have used another Hebrew word called Eloah. Now, the word Eloah is in the Hebrew. It is used 250 times in the Old Testament, Eloah. 250 times. It means God. It means singular God. A one person. You know, we're talking one person. Elohim is plural persons. Okay? Plural. So while Eloah is used 250 times, Elohim is used 2,500 times, 10 times more often the word is Elohim than is Eloah. So the general pattern in the Old Testament, the general pattern is that the plural noun, Elohim, is usually followed by a singular verb. Elohim does, that's a singular word, not do. Elohim said, you know, Elohim goes, and so on. All right? Elohim speaks. So it's plural noun, singular verb. However, there are places, quite a number of places, where the plural word Elohim is used, and of course it's used of the true God, and yet it is followed by a plural verb. You understand? The plural verb. So what happens was that these people who want to suggest that, you know, God is only one person, they say, oh, well, see, you can't go by that. It's always a singular verb. They imply always, but it's not true. Let me give you some places where it is followed by a plural verb. In Genesis chapter 20, verse 13, and it came to pass when God, which is Elohim, caused me to wander. The actual word is a plural. When Elohim, they caused me to wander from my father's house. It's a plural verb. They caused me to wander. Elohim, they caused me to wander. So it comes to this, Genesis, this is the way, the whole verse. And it came about that when Elohim, they caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, this is the kindness which you show to me everywhere we go. Say of me, he is my brother. That's the Genesis chapter 20, verse 13. Genesis 35 and verse 7. He built an altar there and called the place Ethbaal, because there Elohim, God, they revealed themselves, the plural verb, themselves, to him when he fled from his brother. This is Genesis 35, 7. Look at this verse. Because there, God, Elohim, appeared, and I think King James says appeared, means they appeared to him, revealed themselves to him when he fled from his brother. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 23. It goes like this. And what one nation on earth is like your people Israel, whom God, Elohim, they went to redeem for himself. It's a plural verb. Elohim, they went to redeem for himself as a people and to make a name for himself, and to do great things for you and awesome things for your land before your people whom you have redeemed for yourself from Egypt, from nations, and from their gods. So again, plural verb, plural noun, plural verb. Psalm 58, verse 11. And men will say, surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely there is a God, Elohim, who judges. Surely there is Elohim who they judge on earth. It's a plural verb, they judge. Interesting, other places you have statements where you have something referring to God, but it's referring to God in the plural. For instance, not the word God, but it's referring to God. For instance, in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 1. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth. Well, the word creator is plural. Remember also your creators in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years come in which you say, I have no delight in them. Job 35 and verse 10 says, but no one says, where is God, Elohim, my makers? Nobody translated makers, they translated maker. Where's God my maker? But the Hebrew word is a plural word. Maker is plural. God my maker in plural, who gives songs to the night. And in Proverbs 9 and verse 10, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy ones. The knowledge of the holy ones. It's a plural word. The knowledge of the holy ones, and it's plural, is understanding. Isaiah chapter 54 and verse 5. Listen to this one. You have two words here, maker and husband, and they're both plural. For your husbands is your makers, whose name is the Eternal of Hosts, and your Redeemers is the Holy One of Israel, who is called on the earth. So maker, husband, both plural. Okay, you have a number of places like that. Job 5 and verse 1, call now, is there anyone who will answer you? And to which of the holy ones will you turn, holy ones? So you have all these plural things. You cannot just write off that Elohim, plural, is always followed by a singular verb. Besides which, you have Hosea chapter 11, verse 12. Ephraim surrounds me like with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. Judah is unruly against God, even against the holy ones who are faithful. Isaiah 6, verse 8. Also I, Isaiah is talking, heard the voice of the Lord, and the word is Adonai, but it's plural, saying, whom shall I, that's a singular, send, and who will go for us? Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? This is God saying, who will go for us? Now, you know that God uses the word us. Remember, in the book of Genesis chapter 1, man, he said, and God said, let us make man in what? Our image, in our likeness. And in Genesis 11, verse 7, when God saw that they were reaching with this Tower of Babel there, he said, what? Let us go down and confound their language. Elohim, then, is a plural word. But it's like a family name. It's like Elohim. Elohim, God. And you're talking about family. Now, in English, we have words that we know mean more than one person. If I said an army, I would use the word the army is, and I would use the army is, singular verb, marching. Army is. What would you think? Just one guy walking? The army is marching. There's just one man walking down the street. No, you would say the army, well, all those people marching. The army is marching, but the army is, used with a singular verb here. You would say the church is having a potluck. Church is. Would you just think one person, or do you think the church, many people are having a potluck? A family is going on vacation. The family is going. Just one person is a family. See, we have these words in the English which correspond to that. Correspond to that. And here's what New Testament says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 12. For even as the body is one, body is one unit, okay, and yet has many members. Okay, you got one body, but many members. And all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body. You got a lot of members, but they're just one body. So also is Christ. Christ then encompasses many people, many in the body. And in verse 20, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 20, but now there are many members, but one body. So you say, the body is, that's one body. There is one Elohim. I do not worship more than one God. I worship one God, Elohim. Elohim is my God, okay? And encompasses his son and hopefully many sons. In bringing many sons to what? To glory. You know, we throw this word glory around like it was just, many sons to glory. Paul said, I reckon the sufferings of this time are not worthy to be compared with the glory. What does that mean? What's glory? Glory is shining bright like the sun. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says this, There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is one kind of glory, and the glory of the earthly is another. There is one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon. You know, there is a glory. You ever go out on a bright night, it's clear night, the sun, the moon is reflecting that shining, you see the shining of the moon, it's like, oh boy, it's like a light that's lighting up a lot of things here, even though it's supposed to be dark. There is a glory of the sun. I love to see the glory of the sun. I love it in the morning. It's our kitchen window faces east, and I love to see that sun come up and those spears of light just begin to come over the top of the horizon. You know, I call it the horizon, and the sun rises. It's a glorious thing. And some days when the clouds are there, it turns various colors. It's one of the most beautiful things. There's a glory of the sun, a glory of the moon, another glory of the stars. And each star differs from the other, from star to star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown a perishable body, is raised an imperishable body. In other words, glory means shining, brightness. The apostle Paul, some of the apostles got to see Jesus while he was on earth in his glory. This is in the book of Matthew, chapter 17. It's called the Transfiguration. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shined like the sun. And his garments became white as light, gleaming. His face is shining like one big headlight beam, like the sun. And his garments became bright. We have a picture of Jesus Christ in Revelation chapter 1, verses 14 through 18. Beginning in verse 14. His head and his hair were white, like wool, like snow. You ever see snow on a bright day when it can sometimes be blinding? His eyes were like flames of fire, his feet like burnished bronze. And when it had been made to glow in a furnace, like bronze that was still glowing, I was coming out of a hot furnace, and his voice like the sound of many waters. In his right hand were seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was the face like the sun shining in its strength. And when I saw him, John says, I fell at his feet like a dead man. And he placed his right hand on me, saying, don't be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one, and I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys to death and Hades. So here's Jesus Christ, shining like the sun. And what is God's purpose? God's purpose is to bring many children, many children, to what? To this glory. So that your face will shine like the sun, so that your garments will gleam white, so that you will have that glory in you. And how is he doing that? Why is he doing it? And why is there suffering today? And why are these tests that we get constantly? We have tests that come to us. A test. Trial of your faith. It's called a trial of your faith. There are tests of our faith, absolutely. And what about our holiness? Why is God trying to make us holy now? Be ye holy, God says, for I am holy. He's trying to make us holy. All of these things are part of what we are calling salvation. What is our purpose? Why did God put us here on earth as humans? Or as one little boy said, when he wrote to God, he said, God, you know why? Instead of having these people, they live and they get old and they die, and then you have to get new people, why don't you just keep the ones you got? Why don't you just keep the ones you've got? Well, God has a plan to do that. God is going to keep the ones he's got. He's going to keep them forever. And it's a pity, it's pathetic, that people go to church week after week and have no knowledge of the glory that will be revealed in them. And we'll talk more about God's purposes. Why are we here on earth?